Thanks to Chris for helping to set up this talk, and to the faculty for inviting me here. It's always fun to talk about my book, and a particular pleasure to be here. I know it sounds corny, and you must be tired of hearing about it, but it is a pleasure to come here to UVA, Mr. Jefferson's University and all that. We work on Jefferson for 15 years, as I have done. I appreciate how incredibly hard he worked to get this university off the ground, and how outrageous an idea it was at the time. A public institution of higher learning supported out of general taxpayer revenue and unaffiliated with any established church. Only a madman could think you could have that. So I wrote this book. It's the last time I say it. It's my book. In Search of Jefferson's Moose, as Chris says. It's the internet through Jefferson's eyes. What I tried to do, as Chris mentioned, is to rewrite this book, which is Jefferson's book, Notes on the State of Virginia. His extraordinary, although pretty obscure, many of you may not even, have any of you read this book, actually, Notes on the State of Virginia? A few, small number though. It's a pretty obscure work, actually. It's his 1781 compendium about the New World and everything in it, or everything he knew about it. And I tried to rewrite that for cyberspace. It's a hard book to summarize in 20 or 30 minutes, and that's not what I'm going to try to do here. It's a hard book to summarize because it's not really an argument. If it were an argument, I could give you the main points and sort of get you to the end and my conclusion, and then we could talk about that. But it's not. It's a perspective. It's sort of a metaphor. It's a way of looking at things, a way of looking at the internet in particular, but not only the internet, I think. It gets built up over the course of the book, piece by piece, and it either adds up to something coherent at the end or not. And I leave that to you as a reader to judge. But what I can't do is take you through it all in 20 minutes. We'd be going too fast. We'd all be dizzy. What I can do is to tell you a little bit about why I wrote it and what I learned from it. I wrote the book for a number of reasons, but the big one was this. I've been working on internet law issues for about 15 years. It's not exactly the lifespan of the internet, but it's pretty close to the entire period that the internet has been a factor, a force in national and international consciousness. 1994, conventionally being sort of the birth of the big public internet with the release of the Mosaic browser and the birth of the web. And over that period, I've been trying to get people to do something that seemed to me, and still seems to me, to be pretty straightforward and sensible. But which I found strikes many people as radical and outrageous, or even absurd. And it is this. It is to ask the question, if this were a new place, if it were a new place, the internet, cyberspace, planet internet out there, just discovered, a new island that emerged from the Pacific Ocean, what kind of law would we want there? And how would we want it to be made? And it's just a metaphor. It's just a thought experiment. I understand that. I'm not a dope. I know it's not a planet or an island in the Pacific. But I would think it's a useful one, useful metaphor or thought experiment, as a starting point, at least, for a discussion of internet law. What kind of copyright law, say, would make sense for the internet? If we were writing such a thing, copyright law, and if we could start fresh on a blank slate for this place, surely a comparison of that, whatever we come up with, and the law we actually have would be helpful in understanding what the law we have should look like and what we want it to do. As I said, it seems to me pretty straightforward and particularly useful. Because when you do that, when you look at it that way, if you try to answer that question, what kind of copyright law would make sense for the internet, it's so obvious, it's even self-evident, to use a Jeffersonian phrase, it is self-evident that you would not come up with anything remotely resembling the copyright law we have. down to its very fundamentals. He pauses dramatically for... How so, you might ask? Well, here are some of the things surely we would not have in this copyright law for this place. Since I began this talk 7 minutes ago or whenever, 4.6 million copyright-protected works, each one with an owner or owners, have come into being on the net. Or maybe it's 22.5 million or 111.6 million. Nobody knows, of course. There's no way to know. But it's a very, very large number. It's a very large number. That's how our copyright law works. Copyright protection, those of you who are taking copyright law will know this. Copyright law, copyright protection begins the moment a work is created and fixed in a form from which it can be perceived, reproduced, or communicated for more than a transitory duration. Placed in a blog posting, included in an email, saved in a Photoshop file, a Word document, a video, an MP3, etc., etc., etc. Copyrights already attached to it. As the Copyright Act puts it, copyright protection subsists in it. From the moment of creation. No registration is required, no copyright notice is required, no deposit with the Library of Congress. We've gotten rid of all that. Nothing, actually. Nothing is required for it to be protected. Now, that's a very odd rule to have, I think, in a place where original works of authorship are being created in such unimaginable numbers. You couldn't keep track of copyright ownership on the net if you wanted to. There's no processor big enough or powerful enough to keep track of who owns what, not at this scale, not with these numbers. It would strike us as odd there on planet Internet to begin with a rule that at the very outset is impossible to manage. Doesn't seem like it's going to be very helpful in bringing order to this place and allowing people to manage their affairs in an orderly way. And it gets worse, of course. Because every time one of these 4.9 million or 22.5 million or 1.6 billion works that was created in the last few minutes is reproduced every time, that's an infringing act. That is presumptively an infringing act. It's possibly, presumptively, it's possibly excused by some exception or defense, but it is infringing unless it is excused. Now, Planet Internet is a place where the reproduction of information is fundamental to its existence. That's part of its nature. It's part of the way things are on the net. You don't have an internet, at least you don't have this internet, without the reproduction of information. The internet doesn't really do much other than that. That's how it does its job. That is its job, getting information from one corner of the network to another. Each step presumptively infringing a violation of the copyright holder's rights, unless you can point to an exception or a defense. So now we're talking really big numbers. We're talking billions of copyrighted works being reproduced billions and billions of times, each work protected, each reproduction presumptively infringing. Am I missing something? It is self-evident to me that this is not the rule we'd choose if we were starting fresh, if we were writing copyright law for the net to make every act of reproduction presumptively a violation of someone's already existing rights. Why would we? It's a system that will be impossible to keep track of. Impossible. Why would we start with that? These rules that we have don't scale. They don't. However well-suited they may have been to the world of atoms, they're ill-suited, grotesquely ill-suited, I would say, for the world, the network ecosystem of bits, because they don't scale. The amount of processing you would need to manage this system is astronomical. You would need decades to process the copyright implications of 1 hour's worth of activity on the internet. Decades. Why would we, if we were starting out fresh, set up the system that way? protecting pretty much everything and making pretty much everything that happens an infringement. There are lots of other examples. Even a casual glance around this place, Planet Internet, reveals some extraordinary new forms of collaborative authorship and collaborative production of creative works. Open source software, Wikipedia, Web 2.0, user-generated content, remix, culture, whatever you want to call it. I think extraordinary is the right adjective. Not only didn't we have anything like Wikipedia in 1985, we couldn't imagine anything like Wikipedia in 1985. And any of you who were around in 1985 want to challenge me on that, I'm happy to do that. It was unimaginable. You could have the largest reference library in the world created by 200,000 anonymous volunteers. That's a good one. We would surely not have a rule on Planet Internet with respect to these interesting new forms of production, of creative output, that their copyright status depends on the intent of the contributors, which is the rule we have. It's even worse than that. I don't know if you've done joint authorship, but it's even worse than that. It's a double intent standard for determining joint authorship. That's the rule we have. And surely we wouldn't declare that to figure out whether any one of these hundreds of trillions of events constitutes copyright infringement, we'd have to apply a four-factor, case-by-case balancing test to each one of these to see whether the presumption of infringement can be overcome. That, of course, our current fair use doctrine. You could not evaluate the joint authorship or fair use implications of 10 minutes of internet activity if you had until the end of the century. You can challenge me on that later if you want to, but if you don't, I think the implications of that are profound. I think, again, strikes me as... Finally, if we were thinking about copyright law we want to have in this new place, we'd surely look for a copyright law that does the things copyright law is supposed to do. Incentivize people to do creative things that they wouldn't otherwise do, while permitting the widest possible distribution and dissemination and reuse of the works already created. And we'd look around Planet Internet, a place where, admittedly, copyright law has been flaunted and usually ignored, but where certain kinds of creative activity, at least, have flourished. And we would take that into consideration. We don't need copyright for works that will be created anyway. Copyright is not a natural right belonging to authors that must be protected at all costs. It's a social right we grant because and to the extent we believe it makes us all better off. That, by the way, is a Jeffersonian insight, as Chris was saying. The first really important intellectual property theorist in the United States, and the first person, I think, to articulate that particular view of copyright and intellectual property. And it's one that has become dominant, the dominant theoretical justification for intellectual property. It is in the nature of ideas, he wrote, that they should spread freely from one to another, over the globe. Ideas are like the air we breathe, incapable of confinement or exclusive appropriation. They're like fire. They expand over all space without lessening their density at any point. The moment an idea is divulged, it's in possession of everyone. And the receiver cannot dispossess himself of it. But no one possesses them the less because others possess the whole. He who receives an idea from me receives instruction without lessening my instruction, just as he who lights his candle at mine receives light without darkening me. I mean, how can you not love a guy who could write like that, I think? You don't get rights to protect your intellectual property from the nature of things. You get them from society. They derive from social law. The Copyright Act, for instance, that doesn't mean we shouldn't have intellectual property. It only means we get to decide, and we have to decide, whether to have them or not, and how much of them to have. Society may grant exclusive rights, or it may not. So we would look around Planet Internet, surely, and ask what works require the incentive that copyright law provides, and what works do not. It's obvious that there are many works that fall into the latter category. Were that not true, the internet would be what Jack Valenti thought it was going to be, a barren wasteland with nothing there. But it's not a barren wasteland with nothing there yet, even though copyright law is so ineffective. Notwithstanding the lack of effective copyright protection on the net, it's hard to say that it lacks creative activity. Again, that doesn't mean we should get rid of copyright law on planet internet, but it does mean that we should think a little more carefully than we have in the past about what kinds of things need and what kinds of things don't need copyright protection. Now, reasonable people on planet internet are going to disagree, of course, about exactly what kind of copyright law would be best in this thought experiment. But that's the conversation we should be having, it seems to me. What kind of law makes sense in this environment? And if it's not the law we have now, then how do we transition from here to there is the copyright conversation we should be having, but it is not the copyright conversation we've been having very much in copyright circles. We don't seem to be talking much about how we get from the law we have to one that actually makes sense in this environment. Instead, the copyright conversation is about how do we make our current law work? How do we make it stronger? How do we make it more effective? How do we make it more enforceable on the net? So if that conversation is not taking place, it seems to me my metaphor is not working. My thought experiment isn't grabbing people where it should. And then it hit me. Although not actually until I finished writing the book that I need a moose. Ah, yes, I need a moose. Let me tell you the story of Jefferson's moose, and then I'll tell you the story of my moose. I'll show you mine also. That's why he had this white thing behind me. In 1787, while he was serving as the ambassador to France, Jefferson had the complete skeleton and carcass with antlers of an American moose, 7 feet tall at the shoulders, shipped to him in Paris, where it was reassembled and installed in the entrance hall of his residence. An amusing little episode, you know, Jefferson at his most lovably eccentric. I came across it years ago, and I would use it in talks and in papers from time to time just as an amusing little episode, you know, an example of that eccentricity, the Jefferson nobody knows, the Uncle Tom, crazy Uncle Tom. You come across a lot, now you have to keep in mind, I didn't really take it seriously for a long time, and in partial excuse, is that you come across a lot of odd things like that when you work on Jefferson. He was truly eccentric. A few of many examples. He kept detailed records of the first and last appearance of 37 different fruits and vegetables in the markets of Washington, D.C. every year, annual records on the first and last appearance, while he was serving as president. He kept grizzly bears on the White House lawn. He smuggled several bags of rice out of Italy to have them sent back to the United States at a time when it was a capital offense to do that. He would have been executed had he been caught. He compiled the grammars and vocabularies for 50 Native American languages. He wrote a 9-page letter about wind. And at a time when he was in excruciating pain from having broken his wrist, he 9-page letter about wind. But I think my book got really interesting when I tried to take the moose episode seriously. I really was in search of Jefferson's moose, not the moose, but the meaning of the moose. What was he up to? What did he care about? And why did he care so much about it? To go to the expense, which was considerable, and the trouble, which was immense, to have a moose shipped to him in Paris. And in 1787 was one of those turning point years in history. France is collapsing. He's the ambassador to France. The Constitutional Convention is starting in Philadelphia, and he, of course, his disciples and enemies are also there. He's in the middle of this. He had a lot on his plate. He had a lot on his plate. And he, nonetheless, he wrote in a, he called the moose in a letter to a friend, an acquisition more precious than you can imagine. You know, was he serious? And I think he was serious, actually. And he was up to something. And it was something, a lot of things. All of them important. He shipped the moose to Paris because, I'll get you to the end of the book. He shipped the moose to Paris because it was big and because it was new. It's the new I want to focus on here, but let me talk a little bit about the big. I have a lot to say about the big in the book. The moose was about, this was about scale. It was about Jefferson's search for the laws governing the growth and size of things. How small things get big and how big things get small and what happens as a consequence of that. Biologists think a lot about scale. Map makers think a lot about scale. Architects think a lot about scale. Not surprisingly, Jefferson was a great map maker and a great architect and a great biologist. He shipped a moose to Paris because he was having an argument with a number of very prominent European scientists, a debate about the relative size of animals in the old world and in the new world. There was a theory advanced in Europe that animals in the new world were actually smaller versions of their old world counterparts. And Jefferson thought that was hogwash, and he spent an unbelievable amount of time over a 10 or 15 year period refuting it. The moose, the largest of the known New World quadrupeds at the time, along with the bison, far larger than its European relatives, the caribou and the reindeer, was, he hoped, you know, the coup de grace in that debate. The nail in the coffin of this theory would be this moose standing in his entry hall. On this, the big, he was up to something really important. Jefferson's study of size and scale helped him to solve one of the great scaling problems in political history, the problem of the extended republic. How do you get republican government, which history showed could only work in small communities, how do you get it to work at large scale across an entire continent? Many people, many very smart people, Hamilton among them, who was no dope, believed it could not be done, that it could not work at large scale. And Jefferson solved that problem. If this were a talk about the big, I talk more about that. I talk a lot more about it in the book, but it's not. So you just have to read the book if you want to know how that worked. Because this is a talk about the new. The moose wasn't just big, it was new. Jefferson was killing, I just thought of this morning, Jefferson was killing two birds with one moose, the big and the new. He wanted to dazzle, he wanted to show people in the old world that there were, in the new world, things they had never seen before. It was part of a lifelong project to create the new world, the belief in the new world, a belief that this was a new world that was not merely a projection of the old, to start fresh, to wipe the slate clean of old ideas, old ways of doing things, so that we could design a system more appropriate for the new place. So what's my moose? That's what I need, right? I have to get you to see that this is a new place. So I gave this talk. I didn't figure this out in writing the book. I figured it out in talking to people after having written the book. I gave this a version of this talk at Stanford, back in April, and Larry Lessig, who many of you know, he's sitting there in the front row, and he's listening to the talk, and we're all colleagues and friends, and we have a little discussion at the conclusion of the talk, and the next day, on his blog, this shows up. Not that. Oh, I hit escape, and then I go here, and if I press this, he says, this is Jefferson's moose. This video is Jefferson's moose. If you come to the net armed with the idea that the old system of copyright is going to work, and is going to work just fine here, this, more than anything, is going to get you to recognize you need some new ideas.
What can I do? That 16th note groove
just straight.
Going. You'll be amazed.
Okay.
Do it again.
playing single notes, somebody playing chords, and they'll mix them together.
Okay. And let's just pick the mother of all funk chords. Let's pick a ninth chord.
Here we go. They're not all playing together at the same time, you realize that, of course. They don't even know each other. Question and answer session. That'll be your reward. You get the idea. It's pretty good, I think, as moose go. You roll that out and you say, we need some new thinking about copyright law. Clearing the rights to this video would take you 1,000 hours? 40,000 hours? I'm going to the New York Copyright Society on Wednesday. I'm going to ask people to give me an estimate on that, sort of hard-working copyright lawyers. But that's my guess, if you could do it at all. The fact is, you really can't. The rights to the musical works that are being used, the rights to the sound recordings, the rights to the audiovisual rights, all being combined. Who owns this video? How would you get permission? Who owns the copyright? Oh, and we have to analyze whether they've used the underlying work unlawfully, because then they may not have copyright in their contributions. It's a who and who are they? How do I find them? Where do they live? I need permission from them. Even if Koopman, who is listed as the author of this compilation video, this combined video, even if he wanted to comply with copyright law, he couldn't. There's no way. If he came to you as a lawyer and showed you this and said, I'd like to comply with copyright, I'm a law-abiding citizen, tell me what you need to do, it would take you until the end of the next decade before you came back to him and said, I can only find a quarter of the rights anyway, so I can't really give you, you can't, is the answer you would give him. There are, of course, millions of these, maybe hundreds of millions of them. And for each one, it would take you longer to clear the rights than it took to create the work. That's a system that is profoundly out of whack. Copyright is supposed to be about empowering creators. That's why we have copyright law. But it's not doing its job anymore. It's just not doing its job anymore. So that's the conversation I want to be having. Thank you.